Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
NBC Sports Football Morning and American columnist Peter King, what do you think about the Chase Thomas podcast?
I'd like to plug the Chase Thomas podcast. Listen to Chase Thomas. You'll be a smarter sports fan and obviously a much better human being.
Matt Chernoff from 680 The Fan's Chuck and Chernoff show here. And I want to say thanks for listening to today's episode of the Chase Thomas podcast. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast apps. Chase Thomas went to Parkview in North Georgia. He's a local Atlanta kid, and he won't let the Luka versus Trey thing go. He interned with us back in the day, and you'll always remember him. Anyway, definitely go check out ChaseThomasPodcast.com, where you can find all of Chase's previous episodes, all of his articles, and do him a solid. Leave him a rating and review if you're an Apple Podcast listener. Reminder to listen to our show, Chuck and Chernoff, Monday through Friday, 3 to 7 on 680 The Fan, and subscribe to my podcast as well. Welcome to Matlanta, wherever you get your podcasts.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything School HQ over there in Knoxville, Tennessee as well. Rocky Top Insider's own Ryan Shumpert. Ryan, good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Really fought some Wi-Fi issues tonight, so hopefully, feels like we got it all settled up.
Why are we opening with that? Don't say that out loud, because now we're just putting it out in the atmosphere.
What we're doing is we're getting in front of the problem. If it inevitably comes back up and I look like a dummy at some point in this podcast, maybe people will be like, oh, he's probably having Wi-Fi issues. So just going out, getting an excuse just ahead of anything dumb that I do or mess up in the podcast. It's on the Wi-Fi.
I love it. Just get out in front of it. From Ryan Shumpert over there, supporting the Latte Larry's establishment, fine establishment over there in Southern California. Out of spite. You want a good spite coffee shop. Those are the best kinds. Also here over there from Always College Football and Omaha Productions, the full-time man himself, Jack Foster. Jack, good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing well. It's been a while since I've been on here, so happy to be back. And of course, I see Ryan a lot, but Chase, I haven't seen you in a while, so it's good to see you.
Oh, good to see you too, sir. Well, we'll talk off air. I might be around a little bit more in person these days. We're going to see with TPL Tennessee how that's going to unfold. But thank you guys, as always, for being here to talk a little bit college baseball, some college basketball, because a lot's happening here on the Tennessee front this weekend. 24 hours, though, after Tennessee goes down to Kentucky at home on senior night. The biggest takeaway that you're still thinking about 24 hours removed from last night's regular season finale inside TBA, Ryan Shumpert.
Was Tennessee starting slow? Can you just put that all on senior day, essentially? That's the question that I'm asking myself, because I think that there's some fairness to that. You know, Rick Barnes talked about them being too emotional early in the game and in the first half, and Josiah Jordan James talked about it being really hard. And like, yeah, Tennessee finished warmups like at the normal time. I figured they'd finish warmups 15 minutes early, and everything would just be pushed up a little bit with senior day, but not really. I mean, senior day happened and the game started like 5 to 10 minutes later. So is it that? But on the other end, this is kind of a common theme for Tennessee now. They've lost 7 games this year, and 5 of them they've played really poorly to start the game. Now against Kentucky yesterday, against South Carolina at home, they didn't necessarily get down big, but you could tell from the jump they were not clicking. Their other 3 losses, I guess, at Mississippi State, North Carolina, Texas A&M, they get down huge, and obviously they end up down by 10 in the first half against Kentucky, and they claw back in the Kentucky game, they claw back in the Mississippi State game, they claw back in the North Carolina game, but it wasn't enough. So as you start looking ahead to tournament time, and when these games get magnified even more, and this Tennessee team that doesn't have a ton of weaknesses, I'm thinking about, all right, how big is this slow start issue for Tennessee? And was yesterday, which is the first time it's popped up, and the A&M game, which is, you know, was like 4 weeks from yesterday, was that just kind of about senior day, or is that a continued theme of an issue we've kind of seen for Tennessee this season?
It's interesting that Barnes talked about the emotional aspect to it, because they were definitely slow right out of the gate. There was definitely a slog there as the first couple of minutes went by. It just felt like they were kind of going through the motions, and just, I don't know, there wasn't a lot of activity, and it felt like not really until the second half is when, or the end of the first, I guess you could say, the run they went on is when they started kicking things into gear and they looking like the Tennessee of old. But for me, Jack, I'm curious. I don't know if Barnes spoke about this yesterday or not, but for me, and I would love to get the advanced analytics on this in terms of how this comes out across the board, all across college basketball. But I think removing Zakai with 2 fouls early in the first half and then never putting Zakai back in, to me, told the story of why Tennessee was in the hole that they were in. I mean, you saw in the second half just how many big time passes Zakai accounted for Tennessee to get back in the game. I thought Zakai sitting for as long as he did after getting that second foul. And I think, unless I'm wrong, he finished with 2 fouls, right, in the game.
Yeah,
he didn't end up picking up a foul. To me, that's a bigger issue of what happened here, and also speaks to why you can't just be, I don't think you can live and die by this rule of, like, if you get 2 quick fouls or you're in quote unquote foul trouble early, you've got to sit and we got to protect you from getting that 3rd, 4th foul, whatever. Cause he didn't. Like, Zakai is a smart player. He's year 3 in the program. He didn't pick up that 3rd or 4th foul. And I think that, to me, I mean, that was really hard to come back from. And I wonder why we're still this ardent in keeping guys on the bench when they pick up those 2 quick fouls.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. And, you know, just having Zakai on the floor is so key for Tennessee this season, too, because of what Santi and Josiah have kind of become. And with what Dalton and Connect is, Santi and Josiah obviously have a little bit different roles, specifically Santi Agavescovi this year more so than past, as he's not really scored for this team anymore. Granted, he had 0 points against Kentucky. So you got to have Zakai on the floor to kind of offset that a little bit and have another scorer, especially when someone else isn't super hot, such as a Gainey or Josiah is having a big game offensively, or maybe even a Dew's not having one of his best games. I think Zakai is a must to have on the floor majority of the time. And it's kind of a trend we've seen with pulling guys with 2 fouls. I do agree with you that it was kind of a mistake. And, you know, just overall, my biggest takeaway from this game is that we hadn't seen Dalton Connect get to 40 yet this year. He had obviously flirted with it, being in the high 30s multiple times. He finally does, yet Tennessee still loses. So that's just a tad troubling when you have a guy go for 40 and you still lose the game heading into March, ultimately, or heading into, you know, obviously the offseason. Ultimately, don't think this game should invoke a lot of worry into Tennessee fans, but that's kind of my takeaway 24 hours out.
Ryan, I mean, with the 40 stuff to what Jack's talking about there, I mean, Barnes talked about this too, of like, Connect's got a, I mean, he wasn't calling Connect the ball hog or anything, but he was he had a line about like Connect passing more. What was the, do you have the exact quote in front of you of what he said?
No, I don't, because of the whole Wi-Fi issue. I don't have many tabs pulled up, but it was essentially like, you know, he's got to do more to try to get other guys involved. And I kind of felt like some people were maybe taking it out of context a little bit. Like he also said those guys got to hit open shots and help them too.
Yeah.
He said it goes both ways. And he said, He mentioned a specific time in transition where he thought Josiah would have had an open dunk if he passed it to him and Dalton didn't see it. And he was kind of like, you know, he just kind of gets tunnel vision sometimes. And he's like, but that's what happens to elite scorers. So I don't think he was ripping him maybe the way some people took it. And I think it does kind of go both ways. Dalton can be better at passing out of some double teams, passing in transition. He sucks so much attention from defenses when he gets in transition. But that's easier said than done for a dude that in all those instances, he had a three over double team yesterday. He scores a ton in transition, even though all that stuff. So the one thing I'll say on Zakai, the Zakai foul trouble, you're right. I mean, that you were on it at the time. And I think I said to you, I didn't like it. I don't know, you know, how much it was going to end up killing Tennessee. And you could tell it ended up hurting Tennessee because just how good Kentucky played in the second half. And Tennessee wasn't, even though they got the lead to four or got the deficit to four, they weren't able to overcome it. The one thing I will say, I mean, you talked about it being so adamant, like, it's still something he does. And last night I thought was a bad decision that he did it. But two games ago, we played Dalton Connect 6-7 minutes in the first half with two fouls. So it's not like he's been quite as set in stone. But Zakai, Dalton, those two, I think you got to play with two fouls. Jonas, I get, because Jonas, you know, what he gives you defensively down low. But Tobe, too, it's like, Tobe Walker, most of these games, going to play 5 minutes in the second half. Who cares if he has three fouls to start it? Part of me wonders, you know, they put Frey DeLeon in and Rick talking about learning maybe get his feet wet. Maybe they were, you know, trying to find something in a game that they didn't need to win the SEC. I don't know. Maybe that's me just excuse making for him. But I definitely think, to your point, that taking Zakai out hurt them, especially, I mean, 14-8, no turnovers in the second half. He was fantastic in the final 20 minutes.
And that's my biggest thing is, like, it depends on, like, how you look at it. Because Calipari was talking about it, like, Tennessee already had it wrapped up and this, that, and the other. But I still took it as, like, I don't understand, I guess, how Tennessee was supposed to view this. Because, obviously, I think any Tennessee fan would have taken 3-1 over this four-game stretch here to close things out beforehand.
Definitely.
It stinks that it was a loss that ended up being the case here for this four-game stretch here against four consecutive top-ranked teams. But Tennessee, and I said before the week, what I was so nervous about with Kentucky was that, like, I just think sweeping Alabama and Kentucky in the same season is just tough. I don't care how good of a season you're having. That's just really, really hard to pull off with what Alabama and Kentucky are talent-wise year over year and offensively year over year in this conference. But the reason the Zakai thing, I guess, kind of raised an eyebrow so much for me was that, like, you're playing still for a one seed. Like, I understand that you've locked up the regular season here in the SEC, but, like, you got a nice little favor from USC later on in the evening, which should help things going into conference tournament week next week. But, like, you're playing for a one seed. And I dropped in the chat, we were talking over the weekend, where I'm like, the difference between winning a title as a one seed versus the history of winning a title as a one seed versus a two seed is monumental in the tournament. Like, we're looking at 63% are one seeds over the last 34 times. Like, this is huge. Like, the difference. So the margin of error, I guess, because this is such a good Tennessee team and this is an all-time great Tennessee team. Barnes may never have a Tennessee team this talented all across the board with a superstar player like Dalton Connect ever again. Like, you have to just kind of, for me, I was just like, you have to understand the moment. And I understand the result. You have to be like, look, we cannot lose. I understand it's crazy town that we're in this spot anyway. And, like, what an awesome run if we end up going 4-0 here. With this kind of schedule, but, like, it just mattered so much to get the one seed. And I think that will be so critical for what Tennessee ultimately does come March is whether they're a one seed or two seed, just because that, for whatever reason, the disparity between the two is so large in the tournament that you just got to lock that down. So for me, I would have just been like, I'm riding with Zakai and Dalton, no matter what, even if they're in some early foul trouble, whatever. You just have to go down with, you can't do it. I just very much disagree with that, with what happened there. And I wonder if Barnes could, if he was offered a do over, would that be something he would change? It's like, I would probably put Zakai back in there pretty quickly. And if I knew we were going to struggle as much as we did until those final few minutes of the first half, if you could get a redo there, I don't know. We'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. To your point, I don't know what he would have done. I mean, I definitely think you would think so. And, like, that's the thing. This isn't even Zakai of last year, who found himself in foul trouble a lot. Like, how many games has this guy been in foul trouble this year? And you said earlier, yeah, he didn't pick up an entire foul in the second half. Like, no one on this team has more trust, has more of Rick Barnes' trust in Zakai. And again, yeah, maybe it was tinkering, but I wouldn't, it didn't feel that way to me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was something they threw Freddie out there for a minute, where I would think, you know, if given a do over, maybe he would do that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's something he would probably do over. And, you know, you talk about the loss too. You mentioned USC did Tennessee a huge favor by beating Arizona. You know, and Lenardi still has Tennessee as a one seed last time I checked.
Yeah, Tom does too.
Yeah, and Tennessee got pretty fortunate with the USC thing. No one was expecting that to happen. But, you know, now that everything's all said and done and we're entering the postseason, I think you can just kind of sit back and look at, yeah, maybe it changed a little bit, and Tennessee probably would have cemented themselves as a one seed had they beat Kentucky, but they're still in control of having a one seed. And yeah, I think that's, you know, good. So Kentucky loss is not detrimental in any way.
No, it just made you more nervous. I mean, we were talking about, like, it's just because the stakes are so high, you know, like, it's just everything is every, like, we're just in the big game here because this team can win a championship. This team is talented enough and deep enough to be able to win it all in March. And I think this is the first time we've gone in with that kind of feeling where it's like, hey, this team, I mean, 2 years ago was really good, and we thought this team could make a Final Four run with Kennedy and company. They were really good last year with the injury to Zakai, kind of changed things, but they obviously went extremely far and got the most out of that group, and just a great story. Like, they just kept fighting and finding different ways to win and having to evolve on the fly like that was huge for them. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how they rebound and how much the conference tournament matters, right? Like, now we're about to find out, because now it's really just between them and UNC. It seems like for that final one seed, I wonder if it matters who goes further in their respective tournaments. Because UNC obviously went into Duke last night and got a big win on the road there too, because that would have been nice for Tennessee if Duke took care of UNC to wrap up the year too. But I think it's probably more important that Arizona lose to USC for Tennessee's one seed stakes. But either way, I am curious if the tournament matters for Tennessee, because they might have to beat Alabama three straight times in the same season for them to get back to, you know, to keep that one seed. I don't know, but it's going to be really hard to beat Alabama three times in the same season. And that might be something they match up, like Tennessee fans were making fun of Nate Oates saying what he did about if a certain player was healthy, how the SEC would have gone for them. That being said, Tennessee, it's just Alabama is still a high powered team that plays in a style that can get hot, similar to the way that Kentucky did, and they can become a real problem. So I'm very interested to see how that ultimately unfolds. Ryan, what do you think was the biggest team difference between what we saw from Tennessee with their victory to clinch the SEC against South Carolina versus what we saw against Kentucky on Saturday night?
What was the biggest difference for the team? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of hard to say. It's just two completely different opponents. I mean, obviously, Tennessee's defense was way better in the South Carolina game, but, like, no duh, it's a lot better. Kentucky's way better offensively than South Carolina is.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that, kind of to both y'all's points about, you know, not feeling panicked about the game. Look, not many people are going to beat Kentucky if they shoot 64% from three in the second half. Not a lot of people are going to beat Kentucky if Antonio Reeves and Justin Edwards and Reed Shepard shoot 15 of 22 from three over the game. It's hard to beat teams like that. And, you know, I thought some of that, I thought Tennessee's transition defense was really bad on multiple moments in the game yesterday where they just did not match up well, and Reeves and Shepard got wide open threes on really good shooters and good days where they were shooting it really well. I mean, that part's inexcusable. But a lot of it, I just kind of felt like in the half court was just Kentucky making tough shots and playing good offense. So, that's the thing you look at as being the huge difference. Or maybe it goes back to what I said at the jump of Tennessee came out crisp against South Carolina, took the lead early, you know, never trailed the entire game, where Tennessee was just kind of fighting an uphill battle the entire way yesterday.
Yeah, it was two very different games. And I wonder too, it's just like we harp on the Zakai thing and certain things going differently, but like, if Kentucky shoots like that, it was just going to be really, really... I mean, the thing, though, that made that game even crazier was just the ending. Like, what was Kentucky doing for that last minute? I mean, that was almost just something that... I mean, I've never seen anything like it, that kind of implosion over the final minute. Have you, Jack?
No. And, you know, I thought Tennessee was in the game. It looked like, I think most people would have said Tennessee was going to lose the game pretty much throughout the second half. But, you know, we'd seen Tennessee come back at Alabama and come back against Auburn. So I thought that Tennessee was in the game the whole way up until the end, obviously when clocks hit 000. But yeah, Kentucky almost gift wrapped it to him. So
yeah, and we'll see what how Tennessee responds. I mean, the final thing too that I think is interesting coming out of this game, Barnes talked about Santi. Obviously, a tremendous part to this university has had to sacrifice a bunch this year with Dalton Kinnett coming on the way he has. 2 points in the final two games here. He had 2 points, and I think he had zero free field goals, because I think his 2 points against South Carolina were free throws. So he did not have a field goal in either of these games this week. He's still shooting 37% from three this year. I don't know. Like, when you talk about confidence and when you think about the confidence of Santiago Vescovi, like, Ryan, what have you seen? Like, is he actually, because I as I'm taking notes and stuff, it doesn't seem like he's getting a bunch of looks. It doesn't seem like Santi's passing up these wide open gimmies. A lot of it's driving, kicking, finding guys, like active hands. Like, he's still been great on defense, I think, by and large. I think a lot of it is just the looks haven't really been there, unless I'm missing something. So when we talk about the confidence, stuff like that, I think last year he just had to take more of those contested shots, and he was hitting a lot of those because there was no primary option outside of Sakai or outside of Santi with what they had on the team last year. But I don't know. Are you seeing the same thing, or do you think there really is something else going on with Santi?
I've been in the boat you just said basically the whole season, and I still largely think that's it. Like, and it goes back to what you said. The past 2 years, even go back to the Kennedy year, like, Tennessee's offense was 85% off-ball screens, floppy actions, Santi run around for 25 seconds, wear out your defender, get you a good look from three. And it's not that now, obviously, because of Dalton Kinnett. I think that's a big part of it. I think he is turning down more contested shots that he's taken in the past, and that's where, to me, it's a fine line of, like, yeah, some of the time it's not bad because he's pump faking and he's getting by guys and he's getting other people open shots, and you're just keeping the defense in rotations, and you got other guys that can beat opponents for Tennessee. But there have been some games where it's like he's just not taking open shots now, and that's not been every game. And the numbers are so drastic that, you know, I think Tennessee wants them to be more aggressive. There's certainly some level of a confidence issue, but again, you say the percentages, like, it's not like he's shooting bad percentages. I mean, just a little bit worse. And even in SEC play, I think it's like 39%. So again, about what he's shot. So I don't know, I guess is my final answer to your question. I think it's a lot of what you said of Tennessee not running the same stuff to hunt him shots, but it does feel like he's much slower to pull the trigger, which sometimes isn't a bad thing. But for Tennessee to kind of be their most dangerous, it feels like they need him to get into a rhythm, not necessarily where he has to, you know, be taking 7 threes a game, but where he should be taking 4, 5, 6 threes every game.
But I mean, when he's shooting a lot of threes, it's not like, I mean, he was 5 for 11 against Kansas and in the Kansas game back in November. That was his highest output of the year. He was 3 for 8 against Ole Miss, so he got a lot of threes up against them. Obviously, a big win there, 90-64. But you go back through it, I mean, I just think he's in a little bit of a cold spell. But, like, I think he bounces back. I wouldn't overreact to Santi's last 2 weeks. This is elite competition he's going up against, and it's a lot of Dalton Kinnett and a lot of other guys to make up Sakai as well. I don't know. I just wouldn't worry about Santi to this point. And I think he's going to have, whether it's the tournament here or the NCAA tournament in a couple weeks, I think you're going to see another 3 for 5, 4 for 8 Santi game from three. And it kind of calms a lot of those fears. But I just don't think you're going to see the consistency because they don't need the consistency from Santi.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, he's not that good. So.
Well, final thing here on basketball. Do you think, now that we've seen the rest of the weekend play out, Jack, do you think this is going to end up being a one seed? And do you think Tennessee has to win the conference tournament to feel really, really sure that they're going to be the final one seed here?
Well, I liked your point earlier of them versus North Carolina going into conference tournament week. If North Carolina wins the ACC, obviously a very tough ACC, wins that tournament, and Tennessee only wins, you know, if they only win one game, I think North Carolina would definitely get the one seed in that scenario. But if UNC wins and Tennessee doesn't, just straight up say Tennessee loses in the finals, does that mean UNC gets it? I don't really know. It's going to be really close. But I don't think Tennessee, it's a must that they win the SEC tournament or anything like that. But I do think they have to have a pulse. So a couple wins is what I would ballpark it at as being a respectable showing. And the likelihood of getting a one seed will be good.
Do you share that sentiment, Ryan?
Yeah, largely. I think two wins is what you target. I think two wins puts them in a good spot. And it goes back to the age-old debate or conversation of, does Sunday matter at all? It really has never seemed like it does. So I feel like if you win those two games, you put yourself in a good spot. Two other things I'll just note of, you know, what to watch for, a rooting guide for Tennessee outside of just North Carolina losing. Tennessee gets the winner of Mississippi State LSU on Friday. Should definitely want Mississippi State to win that game. Mississippi State wins, you got an opportunity to get a quad one win, whereas LSU would be a quad two win. And then that Florida game keeps on teetering back and forth. Florida, Tennessee's home win over Florida keeps teetering back and forth from a quad one to quad two win. It's back down to quad two after Jerry Stackhouse one more year, bring him back. Got a big win over the Gators yesterday. So Tennessee should be rooting for Florida again this week. I don't remember who Florida's the six. I don't remember. I guess they get the winner of Georgia, Missouri on Thursday, and then they win that one, they'll get Alabama. So if Florida can win those two games, I would think that'd be back to a quad one win and give Tennessee a chance to gain three quad one wins only by winning two games this week, which kind of the ridiculousness of the net as a whole.
0-18 in conference play. I mean, that's it's stunning to see.
Being a seven seed in the tournament.
Yeah. That's remarkable. Crazy town. His AD's gone to Arizona.
Kobe Brown made, huh?
I mean,
the great Grant Ramey fired up, got in the meme lab earlier this year. They made the one, you know, like the bonk dog. It's like real big and strong, like massive. And they put like a Missouri jersey on it. And it was like Dennis Gates with Kobe Brown. And then it was this little small dog and said Dennis Gates about Kobe Brown. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, 0-18. Like, that's just crazy town. Well, there you go. What's not crazy town? I guess it is crazy town because Tennessee is just finding ways to just continue to pile up wins here ahead of their SEC home opener against, or wait, is it home or on the road? It's on the road,
on
right?
The road.
Yeah, it's on the road in Tuscaloosa next weekend against Alabama. Tennessee obviously sweeps Illinois over the weekend here. Your strongest takeaway from the Vols sweep of Illinois this weekend, Jack Foster?
Yeah, I think it's got to be the pitching because it's the only part of Tennessee that's really still an unknown. Illinois' pitching staff was not good at all. Tennessee completely teed off on them on Saturday, got the numbers up for everybody. Everybody got in on the fun. Friday and Sunday were a little bit more challenging, but you know they were able to get to Illinois' pitchers at some point. So you got to look at Tennessee's pitching staff and just note how this is going to fill out, and it feels like AJ Causey is going to be that third starter for Tennessee. I think with what he's done, you know, stepping up with AJ Russell being sore these last 2 weeks, starting on Friday night, he's been lights out, just unfazed, pounding strikeout after strikeout after strikeout. He's really good. And, you know, it's a question of, is his stuff going to play against SEC competition? Because, you know, he doesn't have high velocity and he's got the different arm slot. Is that going to translate to tougher competition? I don't see how you can say it's not going to. He obviously has starter experience going back to last year. I know it's at Jacksonville State, but still starter experience. So I think you have to have him as that third starter. Also, especially since Tony Vitello wants to keep Nate Snead in the bullpen at all costs, it seems like.
Yeah, and you read the postgame comments today, it definitely does seem like that's the preference. I don't know. Reading between the lines, it seems like Snead in the bullpen, because he also can go long. Like, that's the best part about Nate Snead right now, is he's just sliding into the Chase Burns role, right? Where Burns can have that long save type deal. And I just feel like Nate Snead is that same kind of guy where he can just go for whatever innings you need to get you through a game and just be like, hey, we're just going to ride Nate here and we're just going to win this game 5-2, whatever. And I'm just not nervous. I don't have to keep making changes. We're just going to let him get the long-term save. And I understand that. Like, if Nate Snead is the plan there to fill that Chase Burns playoff role, I think that's a good spot to be in. I mean, we were talking in the group chat about if AJ's just locked down, AJ Causey, that is, has locked down one of those spots. I feel like, yes, Ryan. I just feel like now the debate may be between where he pitches, because I know you and Jack have varying opinions on where AJ Causey should land in the rotation, but I don't see how you can't have him be one of your three starters going into SEC play.
Definitely. I mean, Jack's takeaways were exactly what mine would have been, and Causey has taken his opportunities and run with it. And, you know, there's probably a little bit of an element, and probably before this week, because Illinois is at least a Big Ten team, of can he do it against the best competition? And it's still going to get harder in SEC, but he was really good too against Texas Tech, which is probably at least one of the two best teams Tennessee's played to this point in the season in a long relief outing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
An opening night. So he continues to prove it. And then, yeah, Nate Snead, the fact that he hasn't gotten a starting opportunity just says they want to keep him in the bullpen. And Tony loves to do that. He loves to keep one of his best arms in the bullpen. We saw him do it with Sean Hundley for years. We saw him do it with Camden Sewell, even though Tennessee's pitching was just so good that he might not even have been one of their best guys. But you have that guy that can go get you the final three outs on Friday night if you need it in a tight game, and then turn around and get six to nine outs for you on Sunday. So no doubt. And yeah, I still think when A.J. Russell gets back, which will be interesting to see, you know, I think he's probably going to pitch this week against Alabama. But, you know, how did his roles fill out? I would still put A.J. Russell as the Friday night guy. I just think he has the electrifying stuff. And I like Causey a little more on Sundays. Hopefully your first two guys can get you deep into games. And if he where I think he probably ends up settling more is being a guy that gets you 5-6 innings a lot, giving up 2-3-4 runs. Good starts, not going to dominate. Maybe I'm underestimating him. He certainly has proven he can be good to this point, but I still think Russell is the guy on Friday night. And Gentry Eustace from the Tennessee, and was there this weekend, asked Tony, I guess, on Friday night, like, what do you look for in a Friday night guy? And the first thing he said, Tony said, kind of laughing after, it was a big leaguer, and A.J. Russell's a big leaguer. I mean, A.J. Russell's a dude that has the potential to pitch in the MLB for a long time, and not to take, you know, I'm not meaning just to take a shot at Causey or anything, but he just doesn't have that high-level ceiling that A.J. Russell has.
But there is something to be said to Jack's point of, like, if it's not broken on Fridays with A.J. Causey, like, do you want to mess with that a little bit? Because, I mean, he's settled in there.
And baseball's so weird like that, to where you just get the routines, and if things are working, you don't mess with it. So, I mean, you talk to AJ Causey, and it seems like he'd be fine with anything. He's obviously happy he's starting, but he's just along for the ride. Super nice guy, just wants to help his team whatever he can. I don't think he'd be like, I really want to stay on Fridays. I think he'd be completely fine going to Saturday.
He's not going to be Chase Burns, is what Jack is saying.
Right. Yeah. There's only very few Chase Burnses in the world, maybe just one. But I just don't know if you're Tony, especially just the first week with AJ Russell being back, do you throw him out there on a Friday? Maybe you just stick with Causey on Friday. And if he struggles against a really, really good Alabama team and it's on the road, then maybe you know how to reassess after that. But also, I think to maximize Tennessee's potential on the weekend, I know Drew Beam has been really good these past two weekends, but it still just feels like, you know, maybe I just like, you know, what Tennessee has done the last 2 years, and you want to see that again because it's worked so well. But Beam on Sundays is just so luxurious for Tennessee to have, and he's locked Sundays down so well these last 2 years. I do think Tennessee could put him on Sundays again because of how talented Kazi is and because of everything Ryan said about AJ Russell. Maybe it's Russell, Kazi, Beam in that order. Kazi on Sunday would be fine. But the bottom line is that these three guys are your starters. I don't think there's any questions about it moving forward.
Yeah. And I mean, we talked about it in the group chat too. And Ryan was like, explain. And it was the vibe of AJ, Kazi, and Chase Dollander the last year, especially, where I think one of the things that fans may have missed about Dolly's year last year, because I feel like a lot of people, obviously he went super high in the draft. He was a first round talent. I think the expectations were sky high for Dolly going into last year. But Dolly, like the run support, I want to go back and like see what his run support really was week over week in 2022 versus 2023, because I feel like it was very, very different just off the top of my head. And it hit more when it was like 1 or 2-0 opponent against Tennessee when Dolly was starting on Saturdays.
His first inning was always terrible.
And that was, but for whatever reason, it didn't affect him. Like he just moved on. He was like, all right, I got my two in and they got their two. And now I'm going to have 8 straight Ks. And we're just, it's going to be the 5th inning before you know it. Kazi has that to him where he's like, he's going to give up a pop fly home run. And you're like, oof, okay. All right. A little shaky. And then before you know it, he has 7 Ks through 3 innings and he's given up only 1 or 2 runs. Like Kazi just doesn't feel like he's going to get in over his head. So I think that's the most comfortable thing about him is that I don't think an inning's going to get away from him. And it never got away for Dolly where you were like, uh-oh, how is he going to, this is a bad start. And then he'd find his way out of it. And then he would just be 5 or 4 innings and a third or whatever, a 1 run, 9 Ks. And you're like, it's a pretty solid line. It's just, it's more frustrating because Tennessee's offense wasn't like what it is this year, what it was last year. And I think that kind of miscast how people saw Dolly last year. Cause I think they saw it as a down year and I don't think it was really all that on Dolly for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, there's some element of though he didn't get deep into games, which he did the year before. It was definitely a down year compared to what he did in 22. I don't think there's,
well,
any
I'm just saying down year
that.
In terms of like, he was still an elite pitcher last year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the production wasn't. The production elite, I mean, yeah, he was an elite talent. And you watched him pitch.
He had 13
and you were
Ks
like,
through
wow,
nine
this dude
last
really
year.
Good.
13.1 Ks through nine.
Yeah, and that's all great. And he was, you watched him and you're like, wow, this guy's really good. He's going to pitch in the MLB for a long time. But again, maybe it's too me comparing it too much to 22 and what his production was then. But he wasn't getting guys out at the same rate and he wasn't getting deep into the games at the same rate. And that's where maybe, you know, I see the Kazi comparison, between the two. And certainly they're very different pitchers, which is why it kind of struck me. I was like, explain it first. I see the comparison you're making. And the thing that I would say is I almost think when we get into SEC play, Kazi's not going to strike out guys at the rate Dolander did. You know, he might strike out guys a lot. But on the other side of it, I think he's going to have the ability to get deeper into games. I think he gets a lot more ground ball outs. He works quicker. He's in a lot less long at bats. And you're going to see him on nights where he has it. Because Chase Dolander would have nights where he had it. And just to your point, he'd strike out 9 guys and he'd give up 1 2-run homer. But he'd throw 95 pitches by the end of the 5th inning. And that's his day's done. And, you know, it's a solid start. It's a good start. And you're like, man, this guy's really, really good. The numbers don't look quite as good as he was today. I think when Kazi's going to be on, he's going to be able to get deeper in games and, you know, be able to eat more outs for you.
No, yeah, that all makes sense. But I do kind of agree with what Chase is saying as far as maybe you give up something early and then settle in and just, you know, rack up the strikeouts. I don't see a reason why Kazi's stuff wouldn't play against SEC competition, why he wouldn't still be able to strike people out at a high rate, because he did it against Texas Tech and he's done what back-to-back double-digit strikeout games against Bowling Green and Illinois, who is Power 5 competition. He had 12 against Illinois. Like, yeah, he doesn't have 99 mile per hour stuff, but there's something to be said about how nasty his freaking slider is and how many backwards Ks he's getting and how many hitters he's making just look absolutely silly. I believe it was the Bowling Green guy who took him yard in the first inning at the end of the 4th inning against Bowling Green. It was a high leverage spot and, you know, Kazi sent him to his knees with a, you know, strike 3 swinging. So he can make hitters look really silly. He's been pretty much phenomenal every time he stepped on the field for Tennessee this season. I don't see a reason why you should be pessimistic about Kazi entering SEC play. Not that you are, Ryan. I'm just saying, like, from what he's shown you, there should not be hardly any doubt.
Yeah, and Kazi, I think, is going to strike out a lot of guys. It's just from, as Chase said, the extremely high bar of how many dudes Chase Dolander struck out is where I think he won't be quite that level. But I still think he's going to be a guy that gets a lot of Ks.
I think there's a sneaky chance. I think a lot of it comes down to AJ Russell's health in SEC play. But I think this rotation could be better than what we saw last year in SEC play.
Yeah.
I think it's possible because I think Drew Beam's better than he was a year ago. So I think you're getting a better Drew Beam. And he's been great. He's just quietly great in that Saturday spot. He's fine. AJ, I mean, Andrew Lindsay was really good last year when he came in and took that Friday job. But AJ Russell, I think ceiling is still higher this season as in terms of what he can be come SEC play than Andrew Lindsay. And then we'll see what Causey looks like on Sundays, if that is where he ultimately goes. But I think there's a path where he can be just as good as what Beam was a year ago on Sundays. I think a totally different kind of pitcher. But I think there's a path where Tennessee's, because Tennessee baseball fans have been really nervous, I guess, about the rotation this year. And I just don't. I think they're going to be fine. I think the upside's even better than it was a year ago.
Yeah, maybe with the rotation. Know, yeah, go ahead.
It was just such a tale of two halves with the rotation last year. I mean, first half of SEC play, it was really bad. And in the second half, it was elite. So that's where I think that that conversation becomes challenging. But yeah, certainly the ceiling with this group is really, really high.
Yeah, Russell's still kind of a tad of an unknown still because – you know, what's the longest we've seen him go? Was it Texas Tech? Because he didn't really go that long in any outing last year as a true freshman. And then now he's dealing with the soreness. So, and against Texas Tech, he ran into trouble there in like the fifth inning after he had just shoved for four straight. So, the trouble came quick for him is what I'm saying against good competition. So I do think Russell is still a bit of an unknown as far as how high that ceiling is. But it is sky high, no doubt about it. As far as the rotation, I agree with you, Chase. But obviously the biggest difference from this year's team compared to definitely the last couple of years is bullpen depth. After Nate Snead, you don't really have, I mean, Combs is good. I think Stamos is good. Binkies looked good. You got guys who are really good. But outside of Snead, I don't think you have a guy that you can turn to and be like, this guy can give you four innings of great relief or three or slam the door on anybody. It may just be Nate Snead. Whereas last year you had Chase Burns, who could do that, which we all know. He's the reason they went to Omaha. And you also had Seth Alverson who could do that. And Camden Sewell, even though he's a little banged up, he could still do that. So the bullpen depth is not really there.
But there's still, I mean, Marcus Phillips throwing heat. He was good when he came in to shut the door on Illinois late on Friday. I mean, we'll see if he gets more opportunities. I think Matthew Dallas, is he still someone we should pencil in as maybe someone who gets some serious bullpen looks? Or is he going to be a Tuesday night guy?
Well, it's weird with him because he looked good in his first two appearances and since he hasn't been able to find the strike zone. So he'll have to bounce back from that before you can trust him with anything.
Yeah, but also Xander. Xander's not going anywhere either.
Yeah, just to that point, there's so many lefties that makes it hard to figure out. And to me, Biggie stock keeps going up. Like I've said on our RTI podcast a few times, like, even coming from the preseason in, like, I like Binky. I think he's a lot better. This is a dude that's going to be really good in the next couple of years for Tennessee. I don't know how he fits in with so many lefties in the bullpen. I'm past that point. Like, I think Binky's going to be a big-time arm for Tennessee in SEC play. And you just keep on mounting left-handed arm after left-handed arm. That makes it harder for Matthew Dallas. It makes it harder for Xander Seacrest. So it's going to be interesting to see what that pecking order is. I mean, we spent all last year being like, man, if you could just trade one of these right-handed bullpen arms for a lefty, that'd be awesome. Now that Tennessee doesn't have any righties, obviously Snead's their best bullpen arm, and he's a righty. Combs is a righty. Phillips has been up and down, but certainly that ceiling's high. He's a righty. You almost wish you could trade one of the lefties for another kind of righty reliable arm.
Final thing here. I mean, Tennessee wins 24-1 on Saturday. They pour it on there. They pour it on really all weekend, and they pour it on against Kansas State on Tuesday night. That people forget is just that, like, a Kansas State team was ranked before this week, and Tennessee just destroyed in their first unveiling of the black uniforms this season. But I think, I mean, it was something we've talked about off air, but you see it, and it's just there's just so much talent on this in this lineup. Like Burke can get tossed and Bargo steps right in. You're like, this isn't any better. Like you just, I mean, Burke has a home run and who knows what was said there, whatever, but Burke's mashing and you just have a Bargo right behind him that you plug in and you're okay. If, you know, you're worried about Rhys Chapman and his start today, guess what? We'll pinch hit Hunter Ensley and he'll hit his first home run of the year. And maybe that gets him going offensively after what he did today. Like Tennessee is just, we talk about the depth questions in the bullpen for Tennessee right now. There's no question that this lineup to me in 2024 is deeper than the 2022 team. The 2022 team had more top end guys in the lineup card, but Tennessee, I think the depth of this year's squad is the best lineup we've seen that Tony can just mix and mash and it just doesn't matter. Like he can just, there's so many options in terms of where he can turn, and as guys get healthier he's going to have more options, specifically at shortstop in the outfield. Like there's more opportunities for these guys. I don't know, I'm still leaning that this, I mean, it was just me, like Robin Villanueva, who had kind of a struggling weekend until his grand slam today. You're like, oh, is he kind of cooling off a little bit? No, he's fine. He's just going to go ahead and grand slam and put Tennessee up 8-3 and they would never look back in that one. Like Tennessee's just really, they're in that same space to me that reminds me so much of 2022, where the confidence and swagger offensively is back and you just, Illinois gets three runs early and you're just like, they're really excited about this, but I don't think this is going to go the way Illinois thinks it's going to go. And I think Tennessee is just like, yeah, we're going to be all right. Like, you're going to need more than three to have a real chance in this game. I don't know. Do y'all get the same feeling watching these games?
I agree that this lineup is really deep. It's about 14 to 15 deep, whereas if you're comparing to the 22 team, what, they're 11 deep, maybe? Mm-hmm. The rotational DH spot, and then everybody else was pretty much set in stone. So, yeah, maybe it is deeper. The high-end talent's definitely not as good as you mentioned, but there's just a lot of talent, and their ability to flip the switch and just pile it on at any moment's notice is very reminiscent of the 22 team. You know, a 15-5 blowout win against a good Kansas State team, like we saw last Tuesday night, never happened last year.
Mm.
You know, outside of maybe just, I believe they beat Vanderbilt 17-1 one time. You know, there were a couple of games like that, but just their ability to hit home run after home run and just pile on and have huge innings like yep. the 22 team did is really apparent so far this year. And when they get hot and there's just really no stopping it. And there's just so much talent. It's hard to really wrap your head around.
Yeah. I mean, the Kansas State team that threw the race too, to add on top of all that. And you know, Jack, you're right. It's how casual they put up crooked numbers that stands out. Like, it doesn't feel, nothing about it feels spectacular. Nothing feels about it feels like, man, since he's going crazy descending, and they just can really casually put up 3-4 runs on you. Quality at bats, like they feel like they consistently have games where they score more runs than you'd think by looking at the hit totals. Like they work good at bats, they walk a lot. The clutch hitting, the home run power with guys on base has been big to this point. And all that will get harder as they start facing SEC competition, but. Yeah, this lineup's deep. It's got a bunch of options and a handful of guys that you certainly feel really, really good about. And it's just can be really exciting when they get going.
Yeah, I'm excited for SEC play. I think it's going to be fun. How about this? We'll end here. Jack, what is your lineup prediction for Friday night against Alabama? What do you think Vitello throws out on Friday night? What do you think is the go-to here?
All right, so the top four are the same. With more Burke, A. McTears, that's not changing. I think Cannon gets a start at catcher. I think Robin starts at DH, so that's probably 5-6, and then Dreiling at left. That's your top seven. Carly's at short. I mean, everything feels pretty lockstep at this point for their A lineup. It's really just the third outfield spot that's a little up in the air, and I think you just roll with Ensley first night on the road, SEC play. He's been there before. He had the home run today, had a couple of hits yesterday off the bench as well. So I think he's, I don't want to say like turning a corner, but he definitely is doing better these past couple of appearances than he was opening weekend or the second weekend. And let's not forget, I mean, Hunter Ensley's still a really solid hitter, and he's probably their, you know, he and Tears are their best defensive outfielders. So having him in center is really optimal, you know. So I think Inslee starts in center, probably filling that 8 or 9 hole at the bottom of the lineup.
And that's my thing, is I just think you got to stagger. I think because you have a plethora of riches at the lineup spot, my thing, and this is just like really getting granular here, but I just think you have to stagger Cal and Hunter Inslee right now. I think that's more than fair, because if you're going to start, both have tremendous value, especially defensively. I just think with the amount of firepower you have offensively, you have to stagger those two. If you're going to, like, week in, week out, these games are now big time. You have just too much offensive firepower to have 8-9 be Cal and Hunter Inslee at any given big game moment, I think.
Yeah, I generally agree. I mean, I think it's, to me, it can be more flexible in instances when weekends Hunter Inslee is hitting well, or situations where, you know, maybe Cannon isn't hitting well in a certain weekend and he doesn't get a DH to start, which I think we saw at least today. Did he start on Friday, Jack, at DH?
I think he started 2 games this weekend, right? Didn't Cal start 2?
Cal started
not behind
Friday.
The plate. Oh, yeah. Cal started. I'm saying Cannon. Did he start at DH?
Oh, yeah. Friday? Yeah. So Cannon didn't start 2. He only started 1
so
game.
So you had 2. Yeah, you had 2 games where Cannon didn't start at all this weekend. Mm-hmm. Really, we feel like when he hasn't started at catcher, most of the time he's been at DH. So, you know, I think that can add some, a little bit of nuance to the situation. And, you know, playing on the road in some bigger ballparks, especially if it's a guy like Drew Beam, where, you know, a bunch of balls, he's going to pitch to contact. I think there's just a comfort level, at least early on, with Inslee being in center. Not that Tears is incapable of playing center, but I think there's certainly a little bit more comfort level with Inslee. Again, generally agree with that premise. I just think maybe there's a little bit of nuance where you can do that and it's not the end of the world.
Well, and we know that Rhys Chapman is a great, you know, option defensively, but his bat hasn't been as good as Robin or Bargo. So if you're going to have Stark behind the plate, but no Inslee, because you don't want 8-9 to be Stark Inslee, you also don't want to have Chapman out in the outfield, because that kind of cancels out the whole theory. So that means you're having Bargo or Villeneuve in the outfield, which, yes, they've made outfield starts for Tennessee so far this season, but I don't know if I've seen a ball hit their way in the outfield so far this season. Literally, maybe Bargo 1 or 2 times, but I don't even know if Robbins had a ball hit his way. So, you know, are those guys going to be able to hold up defensively? Will be a storyline to kind of monitor as SEC play ramps up, if they get those outfield starts.
I mean, I think that's part of it. Is like, I think you could, maybe it's because the reason I think about this so much is that I think Bargo is just such a good hitter. And I just want Bargo in there as much as possible.
He has really good ABs. Yes. I
just think he's valuable. He deserves at least one start a weekend. Like, I just think he's got to get those opportunities, because I think Bargo is one of your sneaky best just at-bat guys in this lineup. He just has to find his way in there. And I think that's why, for me, you try Villeneuve in left, Tears in center, and maybe Dreiling in right, something like that. Or Villeneuve in right, Dreiling in left, and then Bargo at DH. But I think you have to find your way to have that kind of flexibility in one of those weekend games come SEC play. That's at least try. And if it doesn't work and there's some issues out in the outfield, that's the best part of having Hunter still in the rotation. You know, you can just slide Hunter in and be like, all right, this is not working. Hunter's back in here. We can't handle this.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting just to see how, you know, quick of a trigger Tony has on guys who are struggling at the plate. Just letting them kind of hit through slumps or going to replacements. Yeah. They can certainly do that. And obviously that's a fine line as a baseball coach of wanting guys to work through their issues and not mess with their confidence in a game that's confidence is very important. So it'll all be really interesting to watch. Tennessee certainly has a ton of good options there.
And it's a great problem to have. Like, Hunter Inslee started off in the leadoff spot for a reason. Like, he's hit in the top of the order of a team that went to Omaha this past year. He's had a lot of big time hits. Like, he can absolutely get back to that point of being one of Tennessee's best hitters. It's just because the competition is just so deep in the lineup. Like, we have these conversations because it's just Tennessee has options that they did not have a year ago to kind of mix and match and figure this stuff out. But it's a good problem to have either way for Tennessee. Ryan, what can the good folks check out from you over at Rocky Top Insider this week?
Yeah, plenty of stuff getting you ready for the SEC tournament. And we'll also have tons of stuff getting ready for the start of SEC baseball for Tennessee. So stay on the lookout tomorrow. SEC basketball postseason awards come out, so we'll have all the coverage on that.
There you go. Jack, what about you? Always College Football and Omaha Productions this week. What can the good folks look out from you on that front?
Yeah, just believe we're going to have Notre Dame head coach Marcus Freeman on Always College Football this week, so that'll be fun. Maybe do a couple of fun series with Greg this week. We'll see what happens, but definitely the Marcus Freeman interview to look forward to. And then with the Mina Kimes show, you know, just continue draft talk. That's kind of my two shows I've been working on here recently. So continue draft talk, offseason talk. Of course, some guys got paid, some guys got traded over the weekend. So we're about to enter a fun time in the NFL offseason.
There you go. I love it. Falcons, just draft. Or look, I just want sign Kirk Cousins, 2-year deal, guaranteed, that's fine. And then trade up for Drake May, or Drake May falls at 8. Both 100%. You can't mess this up. You can't. I don't trust this whole situation to just one guy. You're taking both. We're signing Russell Wilson, or we are signing Kirk Cousins, and we're still drafting someone in the first round. You're doing both. No questions asked. Sorry. I don't think the Falcons will mess up two guys. We're doing a 2-for-1. We're doing it. When has it ever gone wrong? Ryan Shumpert, Jack Foster, always a pleasure. And I will talk to y'all next week.
This is Ben Ingram, radio voice of the Atlanta Braves, and I'm here to tell you that you've reached the end of today's episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast. As a friend of the podcast, I'd like to say thank you for listening to today's episode and hope you return for the next one. To show your support for the program, tell a friend or coworker or even a family member about the program. And if you're an Apple Podcast listener, leave the show a rating and a review. It goes a long way. That'll do it for me. But don't forget to listen to myself and the rest of the team at 680 The Fan and the Braves Radio Network this season. Go Braves!
Chase, I think I'm going to hear more about you. I really do. I think you've got a way about you, but you're interviewing, your pleasantness, you're smart. So I think I'm going to hear big things about you.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.